Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 31st, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. There's been a series of shocks delivered to the British Empire over the last 10 days or so, which has created an enormous potential for a dramatic change in the days and weeks ahead, not years ahead, but a potential that's immediately in front of us. These shocks include the significant advances made in the Russian-Chinese political and economic relations with the trip of President Putin to China, the rejection of the transatlantic monetarist monstrosity, the European Union, in the European parliamentary elections last Sunday, the vote on last Tuesday in Texas, where 3 in 10 Democrats who voted in the runoff for U.S. Senate voted for the impeachment of President Obama. That's right, 3 out of 10 Democrats who voted for Keisha, the candidate calling for the impeachment of President Obama. And also there was the formal inauguration of the Eurasian Economic Union this week, providing an alternative to the collapsing transatlantic system. Now we can summarize this as Lyndon LaRouche did in his webcast last night by saying that Obama is in big trouble, but that besides Obama's drive for war, there's a second aspect to this, which is the British Empire is out for blood. And at the same time, there's a growing mood of rejection for that British imperial policy, which includes the fascist austerity policy for the European countries, especially the southern European countries, and so on. And the vote for Keisha Rogers in Texas shows that in the United States as well, there's an awakening that the Democratic Party is going to have to change in order to get us into a post-Obama future, because the Republicans can't do it. The Democratic Party, to the extent it clings to Obama, is not going to do it. But the LaRouche movement exists as an outside force which is running an insurgency in the United States and in Europe, and an insurgency which has very clear echoes in Russia and China as well, largely due to the individual diplomacy of Lyndon LaRouche and his wife Helga Zepp LaRouche. Now, joining us today on the program is someone who is also among that upper level of statesmen who has this vision both of the collapse that we're facing, but also the way out, the solution. Someone who is an old friend of the program, Jacques Cheminade, who is the former presidential candidate on several occasions in France, but whose reach extends into North Africa, into the Middle East, as well as into Eurasia. And so we're very privileged to have Jacques with us today. I know Jacques has been traveling in France and has a lot of insights to give us into the situation. So Jacques, welcome to the program.
Yes, I'm very happy to be with our American audience, and I greet all of you who are moving to reestablish United States as a nation and not about Obama's hideous way to proceed.
Well, we are looking forward to the post-Obama era, but we have a little bit of work to do to get us there. Why don't you start by just giving us a summary of some of these developments from your perspective, the shocks that have been delivered and what, how you see them from France and Europe.
First, the resistance to the British Empire is piling in. The British Empire is in big trouble, and we have to rejoice about the results in the European elections. Not because of the parties who won, but because of what they had to represent and the issues they had to raise, because the population cannot stand anymore the austerity that is imposed upon them. The second thing is that we are on the edge here. We are on the verge of an immediate bail-in crisis. European banks are the more vulnerable because they have been playing with their accounts much more than any other banks in the world. Their equity is weighted by risks, and the evaluation of the risks is by the bank itself. So they are strongly underestimated the risk, and there is something called the stress test in Europe. So in a sense, until now it has been a cover-up, but now they have to move. So the British Empire has to expose itself, going into a new form of more directly military and police state, and exposing itself. So at the moment where the British Empire is under attack, it has to expose itself. So that's created a situation where it's all the more vulnerable. At the same time, Geisha Rogers in Texas put squarely the impeachment of Obama on the table, and she has created a shockwave not only into the Democratic Party in the United States, but a shock that of which the waves are reaching our shores here on the other side of the Atlantic, because for the good or for the bad, there is a transatlantic form of back and forth today. We noted from here the big resonance of her campaign in the population, defying popular opinion. And we welcome the process of impeachment that is reaching more and more directly Obama.
Jacques, let me ask you on that. One of the things that Lyndon LaRouche has been pointing toward is, besides the recognizable danger of Obama's policy and NATO's policy toward Russia, that Obama is just inundated with scandals, and the latest being the fact that the Obamacare policy of reducing health care is killing veterans, that there are veterans who go through the Veteran Administration system and are dying because there are not enough doctors and not enough hospitals. To what extent is there a recognition in Europe of the scandals, whether it's Benghazi, drones, the spying, the Snowden case? How visible is that for you in Europe?
Well, we are doing our best to make it visible. People in positions of power are very aware of it. So therefore, they would tend to react to Obama's policy not in the same way as they would have reacted a few months ago. At this point, Victoria Nuland told the French authorities that they should cancel the sale of the Mistral ships to Russia and not invite Putin to the ceremonies of June 6th disembarkment. And even the very weak Hollande had to decide that he maintains invitation to Putin, and Putin will be in France together, of course, with the British Queen and Obama on June 6th. And also, the French have decided to maintain the sales of the Mistral, its two ships, very advanced ships, military ships, helicopter carriers, to the Russians, and 400 Navy people, 400 sailors from Russia are now coming to Brest in France. So also at the Petersburg conference or meeting, the French firms had the main stand with a lot of things in the stand with main French firms, EDF, Total, oil industry, everybody was there from France. So it's a sign that they refuse or they say no to a war option, but they have no peace option.
Jacques, yeah. Let me ask you on that. In the U.S. media, there's a consistent drumbeat of attack against Putin, coming from Kerry, from President Obama, from McCain, from the New York Times, the so-called liberal progressive media, just blaming Putin for everything. How is it in France? To what extent is there what you might call objective assessment of the coup that was carried out by the United States and NATO in Ukraine by Nazis as the cause of the tension there now? Is that something that is covered in France?
Well, people on the other side of the political pipeline going into the city of London and Wall Street, this liberal progressive crowd, is saying the same. I have in front of me an article in Nouvel Observateur violently attacking Putin, saying that he's a big brother of the French fascists, and he's a big brother of European fascists. Nonetheless, even in government circles, it is said that the Russians have the rights to be in Crimea, and that the Ukraine question could not be solved in police or military terms. And Putin is very skillfully maneuvering to create a situation where there will be a big pressure on the French authorities to appease the situation.
Well, I think that's a good jumping off point for what Lyndon LaRouche mentioned this morning, which is that you do have now developing in Europe a potential breakaway from this whole transatlantic policy of austerity and fascism and support of a British imperial war. He pointed to France, Germany, and Italy as the three key nations in Europe. How do you see that?
Well, the so-called Eurosceptics made a big breakthrough at an European level, not only in France, not only in England, and right and left. Syriza on the left side, and the Nigel Farage party and Marine Le Pen parties in Great Britain and France. And it is a sign of the absolute destabilization of the political landscape. France is somehow the epicenter of this earthquake. Why? Because it's a country where the gap between the official political class and the still, let's say, relatively educated people, the gap is wider. And what you have as a result of this election, the good news is that the treasonous parties have been shaken. The Gaullists, who have betrayed Gaullism, and the Socialists, who have betrayed the Jaurès Socialism, were strongly defeated, more strongly defeated than ever, than people would think in the United States or elsewhere. There is a big article in the most read French newspaper called Le Parisien, or Le Parisien Aujourd'hui, which is a paper, popular paper, where they said, shut up, shut your mouth. You in the Socialist Party, you in UMP, which is a so-called Gaullist opposition, you should shut up your mouth. You are full of scandals. You have nothing to say to the French people and how they feel. So you are a sad show, and this sad show should be stopped and something else should emerge. So this means that the true questions are raised, and the future, in a sense, is coming to us, and it hits the world of fancy. The world of fancy is exploding. That's the first thing. The second is...
Jacques, just on that question, how long can Hollande stay in office when he's polling at around 12 to 15%?
You're very optimistic.
The Socialist Party got no votes.
You are very optimistic. The French were asked if you want him to run in 2017 as candidate to the presidency. And those that say yes were
3%.
3%. 12, 15 somehow support him because he's president, but not because he's Hollande. So
they
are.
So that's what
French
you mean when you say the political class has lost its luster, it's lost its mandate.
Because all of them are on unstable, on moving sands. None of them is in a stable situation. And they fear to be in power, because they know if they reach power, they would be in a situation where they have to be heroes, political heroes, and they don't want to be political heroes. I must add, the other good news is that the incestuous relations between French politicians, bankers, and the media, the press, also has been absolutely broken. The bad news, in a way, is that Marine Le Pen got the vote and not us.
Tell us a little bit about Marine Le Pen and the National Front, because there's been a lot in the U.S. media on it, most of it implying that she's changed, that there's something new there. What's your assessment of Le Pen and the National Front?
In such a situation, our ideas should win. That's why they have created, in a sense, synthetically, Marine Le Pen, starting from a National Front that they control since the beginning, and she's, in a sense, at the same time, the voice against the system and a spare tire of the system. Because what she spreads is a kind of national monetarism against the supranational monetarism. And you have the same in England with Nigel Farage. He's against the euro. He delivers very good speeches against the euro. He denounces the European Union. He attacks those in the European Union who went against the Russians in Ukraine. He's very good on these issues. But he says we should leave the European Union to maintain what are the main things that make the British pride of themselves, the City of London and the Commonwealth. So you see, this idea of a spare tire of the system is very important to understand. And that you have to go back into the French history. In 1965, de Gaulle ran as president. So the British at the time did not manage to kill him. They tried to kill him. He almost died in three or four attempts, but they did not manage to kill him. The OAS people, the same that participated in the murder of Kennedy, of the Kennedys, tried to kill him. They did not succeed. So the British had to launch a political operation against him, and then they launched François Mitterrand to take over the Socialist Party. And Mitterrand compelled de Gaulle to run as a second round in the presidential election of 1965, and de Gaulle got only 55% in the second round. So he was relatively weakened, because people expected him to get 70%. So Mitterrand was supported by whom? And it's very interesting if you look at it historically. It was an improbable alliance. What we would call here the Atlanticist socialists, people were on the Anglo-American side. Mm-hmm. The liberal communists, closer to London than to Moscow, and then the extreme right wing with the OAS, who supported Mitterrand against de Gaulle. The extreme right wing supported Mitterrand, who was allegedly a leftist, against de Gaulle. And the guy running this was Tixier Vignancourt. And he had, as head of his campaign, a man called Jean-Marie Le Pen. So you
so
see
Le Pen was part of the Mitterrand apparatus initially?
Yes. Not part of the Mitterrand apparatus, but the one, the kind of buffoon of the Mitterrand. Mitterrand played Le Pen against the right-wing opposition all the time. And Mitterrand always said, it's myself or Le Pen. And some are saying today that Hollande would want to play the same game. In the future, some socialists willing to replace Hollande, to manage to be in the second round of a presidential election in 2015, and together with Marine Le Pen, and that people would vote against Marine Le Pen, so they would vote for them, what Mitterrand did in the past. This won't work. It's a scheme which is absolutely out of our times.
Well, Jacques, what is it that Marine Le Pen is appealing to them? On the one hand, it's the opposition to the EU, but what else is part of the vote for her movement?
Against immigration, like Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage is very violently against immigration. So they say that that she is against immigration, but not against the immigrants. And she changed completely the policy of her father. Her father is still a candidate, and he has been elected with a strong vote in southern France, 29%. She got 32% in northern France. But his father, her father in the past, Jean-Marie Le Pen, was an ultra-liberal. He was for Thatcher. He was for the worst of the Reagan administration. And he was absolutely for a decentralized state. Now, Marine Le Pen completely shifted. Now she's for a centralized state. She is also for, she called for Glass-Steagall, of course. And she moved away from her father's main aspects of his program. And she prepared a program who, except on the immigration issue, and except on the, let's say, call for nationalism and not really patriotism, she created something that could be understood by people who don't go in depth of the issues as similar to us. So I said a synthetic character, because now I know that people in the National Front copied our program to cover up the true options. So Jean-Claude Martinez, now the former vice president of the National Front, and who had been assigned to copycat our ideas, came out against Marine Le Pen because Marine Le Pen dropped him. And he says, I was her teacher at the law school. Her papers were dramatic. She has no greatness. She's vulgar and addicted to, let's say, beverage, whiskey drinker. But in a world of chihuahuas, bulldogs have a great chance to win. So you understand how it works. So I must say, something should be understood. The issue is not Farage, is not Marine Le Pen or whatever, or Syriza or Tsipras on the extreme left. The issue is that something new is now in Western Europe, and it is against the British Empire. So these people like Syriza, like Tsipras, like Marine Le Pen, like Beppe Grillo in Italy or others, have to go against the British Empire. It's the only way to maintain their existence and to get the vote. So it's very interesting because in doing that, they open the road for a true policy of resistance to the British Empire. And that's
Doc, I should tell you on that note that the opponent of Keisha Rogers, who made his millions of dollars through some of the most corrupt people on Wall Street, namely the Michael Milken networks, and spent that millions of dollars initially to fund Republican candidates and then his own campaign, he now is saying that he's an opponent of Wall Street, he's against the income inequality, and that's why he had to leave the Republican Party. But the fact of the matter is, when you ask him, well, what are you going to do against Wall Street, he has no program.
Marine Le Pen is different. She's smarter, and she's surrounded by smarter people. She said, I am for Glass-Steagall, but she says that she's also for leaving the euro. One day she says, it is the euro is a British currency, I'm against it, and she doesn't know what she speaks about because she mentioned the French king who in fact paid back the French debt to the British. But in reality, what's behind it is a position where she says, or she adds, well, on the euro, I would present a referendum. I won't go straight ahead. And we should negotiate during 6 months with people. She said that on TV recently, on the other leaders of Europe. I should negotiate during 6 months to see where we go. And if we go for real policies of the interest of the people and investment in long-term projects, then we will go together in some kind of arrangement. Then she added also that she would not leave immediately the European Union, but she would launch a process of discussion. So now even certain people who were before with her are attacking her. So it's a total mess. One thing that's clear is that a lot of economists now, and also military, are fed up with what's happening. And one thing that creates a clear up what's happening is that you should know, and this is not known, that the Office of National Statistics of the European Union and in also in England have decided to inflate their gross national product by including in the gross national product prostitution and drugs officially. And the European Account Office from the European Commission said it's a very good idea. So now the Italy of Renzi and the Great Britain of Cameron are including this in their accounts, drugs and prostitution. So this should start in September. And it's really unbelievable. When we say that to people, people say, oh, now I understand that you are right.
You know, we used to always say, what's the difference between investing $10 million in a steel mill and $10 million in a casino or a whorehouse? And obviously, the answer in modern Europe is it's better to go with the whorehouse.
Yeah, and they say also, before, to make money, you had to attack a bank. Now it's much easier to become a banker.
Right.
So there are these resistance. I have in front of me a book by one Jean-François Guéraud. His book is The New Criminal Capitalism. So he's not a nobody. He was a head in the French DST, in the counter-espionage services. He was a head of policies against drugs and all kind of traffic And he wrote this book where he says, which is very interesting, there was never a war on drugs. It's never happened, and never they tried. Now what they're saying is that the war on drugs cannot succeed, and that only 1% of the drug traffic is sanctioned. But this is a lie. All the banks were in the drug policy, and he mentions the banks, and then he goes throughout the whole system, saying everything what we say, including the J.P. Morgan declaration, including the J.P. Morgan article of May 28, 2013, their analysis called the Euro Area Adjustment, about halfway there, it's called. And they call for a dropping of the Constitution protecting labor and pensions, and to have a new kind of policy which will be really a bit under non-democratic, as they say. So they would go against what came out, the laws and the constitutions and the preambles of the Constitution that came out in Europe after the victory on fascism in 1945. And he says, he comments, a certain financial capitalism, one worldist and deregulated, means the end of democracy in the way we have known it since almost a century. We are entering into an age of privatization of the world for the profit of private powers, legal, criminal, or gray, and these people vassalize the states and the populations, and they are what we should fight. So a lot of economies are coming on similar lines, and also a lot of military that I talk to. Mm-hmm. But what they say is that, all right, we know this, we have to fight this. But the problem is that there is not a leader in France emerging as a person capable to coalesce all this interest to fight what's falling upon us. And also they tend to be, even when we discuss in depth with them, they tend to be very doubtful of what could change in the United States. So that's their problem. And when they talk to me, they consider me as a very insightful person, a very good advisor, but they don't want to see me as a political leader. Because they are in their own small world. They have not yet emerged from their own small world.
We are listening to Jacques Cheminade, who's our guest on the LaRouche Show today, May 31st, 2014. Jacques, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, has been twice a candidate for president of France, the last time in the most recent election where he did shake up the political establishment, and I assume he's still doing so. Jacques, let me ask you now, Lynn has also been talking about the change in the situation in Germany. You work quite closely with Helga Zepp-LaRouche, whose Busso party ran a very aggressive campaign in the European Parliament. What is the situation in Germany, where Merkel seems to be relatively secure, but on the other hand, no one seems secure over there? What's your sense of the situation in Germany?
It's not very simple, and it's very interesting. The industry factions in Germany, it's the same as in France, but they are more advanced because they are closer to Russia. These people, the industry factions and military factions together, are saying Russia cannot be an adversary, it should be a partner, and there is no way out of that. So Merkel has to a certain extent, accept that, even if she wants to play the card of Obama and the British. So you have this pressure. Our campaign in Germany, with very limited means, created a debate on how it works, like here, how it works to go ahead of this notion of a negative peace, which means we will not go in a war against Russia and we won't accept the terms of Obama or the British. But how we would go into a policy now of a positive peace, which would mean Glass-Steagall, a credit policy, the Eurasian land bridge and the world land bridge, and then for us, exit from the euro and exit from the European Union, which prevents this policy to be. We don't want to leave the euro and the European Union as such. We want to leave them because it prevents our sovereignty to be expressed, and it prevents us to have this policy of a communality of development for the common aims of humanity. This is what the European Union and Europe prevent us to do. So there is this issue, and this issue is making its way in Europe, together with the rejection of the British Empire as an option. And what's interesting in France and in Germany, and also in Italy, is that this option is making its way. It's still a potential, but it's making its way. And this is, in fact, historically, the LaRouche card.
And that is something that we do see in terms of the fight that's going on with Yakunin from the Russian railways, his involvement in discussions with German rail, the whole question of gas and oil
and
from Russia.
Yakunin was in France. That is in France that he was first, let's say, invited by the French institutions.
Yeah.
Who are not at all on the landline. Hollande himself had to change his line. He's saying now, oh, what's happening in Ukraine and what Putin is doing, we may not like it, but it's a matter of fact and it's reality.
But Jacques, as an economist who has written extensively on this question of physical economy versus the monetarist casino economy of Europe, I'm sure you've watched very closely the emergence of Sergei Glazyev and a grouping in the Russian Academy of Sciences around him to a position of influence in Russia. I should tell our listeners that just this last week, the Russian Academy of Sciences had a conference honoring Fobis Kuznetsov, one of the most important scientists from the Academy, and he's now passed away, but the keynote presentation at that conference was given by Lyndon LaRouche. So what's your assessment of the Russian response to the Ukraine situation, not so much the military and so on, but Russia's move toward looking for an alternative to the collapsing transatlantic?
Well, the first option, obviously, is what people call the gas deal with China, which is much, much more than a gas deal. It's a kind of agreement on exchanges between the two countries for a mutual interest based on their own currencies and not on the dollar or on the euro. So
is that explicit, Jacques? Is that in the agreement?
Sorry?
Is that in the agreement that they will be making
not formally. Not formally, but it's discussed around the agreement.
Okay.
Very clearly. So it's still potential, but it's there. So Putin also is not saying what Lavrov and Putin made very interesting declarations. Because you have in Russia certain people, like Dugin or others, who call for a Eurasian or neo-Eurasian empire opposed to the European Union. They say, we, people of the lands, oppose the people of the sea, and the European Union is allied with England and the United States, who are people of the sea. All this geopolitical, which is Alfred Mackinder in reverse.
Right.
It's not at all what Putin is saying. Putin and Lavrov are saying we need, and it's their words, we need a new Eurasian development from Vladivostok to Lisbon. And we have to develop that, and the only option to develop Ukraine is that we have on one side the Russian side, and on the other side the European side. But this means that there is a problem in the European Union, because the European Union is against us, and it sides with the British Empire. So Putin develops this Eurasian policy as an option and not as a thing per se with China and Europe. And people here in France made the mistake to see that as a Paris, Berlin, Moscow axis. But it cannot work like that. It can only work if there is an Eurasian land bridge, including the China Silk Road. And the China Silk Road is seen here something apart. No, it's an overall process. De Gaulle said, an Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, and now it's an Eurasia from the Atlantic to the Sea of China. So this concept, when they develop it, part of the military establishment and economists agree with us, and they agree with the way Putin is proceeding.
As I for believe Putin, the president of China was just recently in Lyon and other cities in France, was he not?
Yeah, Xi Jinping was there, and he delivered a very beautiful speech on how France, if France was France, should be so necessary for China, and how an agreement would be necessary. It's very interesting because part of the Chinese leadership, in particular Deng Xiaoping, but also I think in the family of Xi Jinping, and certainly Chuan Lai, had their early period of life as either workers or students in France. So there is this Chinese-French connection which goes quite deep, even if some people want to make out of it a pragmatic deal, it's not. It goes quite deep into the essentials of both countries.
I was just going to say, on this point, it would be very, very important for you to flesh out what it is that de Gaulle meant when he talked about a Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, because that's very different from what we've seen emerge with the European Union and the whole Brussels bureaucracy. So give our listeners a sense of that.
De Gaulle was strongly attacked by the European bureaucracy in his times, the Hallstein plan, who wanted to destroy the sovereignty of the European nations, and in particular in France. This was also in 1965, the date I mentioned before for the presidential elections. So it was a Hallstein plan, and supported by a lot of people in France, like Raymond Barre or others, who went for that, to debase the nation's sovereignty. So de Gaulle decided to stop going to the European meetings during 6 months, and it was a policy of the chaise vide, when he was on the chair representing France. He refused to be in the European Union at that point. So finally they had to accept French sovereignty. It's interesting to connect that with France, who was the first country to recognize China, not because they liked Mao Zedong, but because they recognized the power of China in the world in 1964. So there is this connection, which is quite active. It doesn't express itself somehow politically, but it's very active in economic circles, industrial circles, and culturally.
And so when de Gaulle was talking about his conception of Europe, it was based on national sovereignty, but what Lyndon LaRouche always talks about is within a community of principle of perfectly sovereign nation states.
Well, what de Gaulle said once is patriotism is to love one's country and to try to get the best of the others and to give the best to the others. Nationalism, instead, in his words, is to reject the other countries and to retreat into tradition, and said, I am not for tradition. I don't like the right wingers because they hate the people, and I don't like the left because they hate the nations.
Well, so I think that would describe the EU bureaucracy have merged the two then. They hate the people and
Europe,
the nations.
The European Union of his time, the European Union of his times, the machin, the thing.
Yeah.
In these science fiction movies, you know, the thing.
Yes. But today it appears as though de Gaulle's worst nightmare would be that you have a bureaucracy that hates the people and the nations.
Yeah, sure. It's there. And now it's known. And the French people are, at this point, are for Europe, but against the European Union. And we made a campaign because we could not run, and I would not have run in the European elections, because to elect a parliament for nothing, it's not worth running. So we put in the ballots the Greek flag instead to put the name of a party. And these European elections were organized to be a farce. In Paris, there were 31 lists, and you needed 3% to be reimbursed and 5% to have one elected person. So in other parts of France, I was 23, 25, 24. And I was touring France during the campaign. And in most places, people have not even put in the official, in France, you have official places where you stick a paper with your name and your list, a picture. There were villages where there was nothing. So it proves a process where something new has to happen. And if you are not in the future, you cannot understand what's happening. Let me go back to this Marine Le Pen issue because it's interesting.
Sure.
The Russians are now denounced because they welcome Marine Le Pen. Marine Le Pen met Rogozin in Russia, and she also met the head of the Duma. I have to remember his name, Sergei Naryshkin. So they say now in France she's connected to the KGB and so on and so forth. And if you see the Russian side, if you put your eyes or put your mind into the Russian side, I understand them. They play that to destabilize the European Union, and they are right on their side. But that's not our job. Our job is to go further and to create the conditions where the real policy of the Eurasian land bridge and the world land bridge can be created. And Marine Le Pen keeps attacking the United States. You should understand that also, that she says it's United States, in saying she never mentioned the British Empire, and she never mentions that France should not pay the debt. So from the Russian side, they say the Americans are controlling the parties favorable to the European Union, so it's normal that we play the other card. And they're right on the side. But our job is to be ahead.
Jacques, in terms of the alternate economic zone coming into existence, the so-called BRIC nations, the Eurasian Economic Union, there are none of the Russian-China deal. There are a number of things in process. But clearly what we're seeing is countries that are opting out of the collapse of the transatlantic. What's your assessment of where this is going?
They have to understand who LaRouche is and who was movement in the United States is, and that Obama is about to be impeached. This is not yet in the minds even of the best people in France. They see it as a very interesting motion, but they don't see it as possible within a relatively short-term period. They don't see that. So I have to bang that on their heads so that they would understand that it's now, that the future is coming. It's not tomorrow.
I think this was the important point in Keisha Rogers' campaign, was that what they focused on with her was the impeachment of Obama, therefore, quote-unquote, she's not a Democrat, unquote, because Obama's a Democrat. And that in itself caused a lot of attention and recognition of Keisha. But the other side of her campaign, which actually was the one that brought out the vote, was her discussion of the need to revive the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy in the Democratic Party, which is the policy of LaRouche, and that is to put nation above party and to look to the future with a new generation of scientific and technological progress. And I, from what I can see in terms of the situation in Europe, that's precisely what your campaign represented in the last election. And that's where you see the blindness of the opposition to the EU, which is that they've almost completely narrowed themselves down to grabbing on to this popular opposition without giving people an outlet for the future.
Well, if you want to understand really what's happening in the minds of people in Europe, I was in Toulouse. So, well, a lot of people came to me to shake hands. I saw they were running around, but they came to me to shake hands. And they said, thank a lot for what you have done for us, but I did not vote for you because it was not practical. I wanted my vote to be useful. So I tell them, now you have Hollande, it's very useful. So they said, yes, you're right. You're right to mock us. And then a minority says, nonetheless, I voted for you. Now you should give them hell. So it's very interesting because this minority identifies itself as soon as they see me in the streets. The vote was very little. It was 0.25%. Funny, we got the main vote, 1%, in French Polynesia, where we had never been. So this raises question about the real honesty of the election, but that's another story. I have no proof. But when you get 1% in Polynesia, where you have never been, and 0.25% in France, where you campaigned and you had many, about 50 hours of television, it raises a question in your mind. So the problem in the field or on the phone when we talk to people is that people would tend to say, we agree with what you say, but it is impossible. Reality cannot be that good, as you say. So you have to give them a sense of optimism and a sense of the future. And the big problem is that French politicians have a certain political knowledge, a meager historical knowledge, but they absolutely lack from any philosophical culture, from an aesthetic culture, and from a scientific culture. Therefore, it leaves the country with a selection in schools based on mathematics and formalism, and people having an extremely limited notion of what truth, beauty, and human brotherhood mean. And we have decided to organize an educational, which would be on the same basis for all our locals in France, on the issue of what is a human being and what is the difference with an animal, and going into the present world situation, starting from there.
And Jacques, when you campaign, when you run up against this hard-headed pragmatism, people who say, I like what you say, but it'll never work, clearly this is the same problem on both sides of the Atlantic. And there's no way to get there by stringing together facts or even program. So how do you inspire the optimism in people? What is it, I mean, obviously this discussion of what is a human being, but just give us an example of when you talk to people, how do you challenge them to rise above this littleness?
We have to be very harsh. The first is that you have to say the truth. People would protest. They would say, yes, we are bothered by immigrants. Yes, we have problems with gypsies who come from Eastern Europe. People from Eastern Europe take our jobs. So I said, your problem is at the moment when you are saying that or seeing that, from behind you have been sodomized by a banker. And the only thing that I hear from you, the only solution that I hear from you is that you want to buy Vaseline. So then people are shaken. I said, well, now this was just a joke. Now see what the future could be for your children and grandchildren with a policy that will go beyond where we are cornered. Everybody in France is against the system at this point. We hate the system. We don't like the system. The socialists who have created this European Union, who have worked for it, had a poster saying, vote for European socialists. They didn't mention it on. Vote for European socialists is a party against financial austerity. So I said, look at this joke. Look at these people that are fucking you and are saying exactly the reverse of what's true. So have a certain sense of the fun. So I tell them sometimes Jewish jokes, sometimes jokes from Nasreddin, who is very known because he was a Joha. He inspired Sancho Panza from Cervantes. So he made these tremendous jokes to make fun of established ideas and public opinion. So you have to have that. And then further, you have to see, look at the future, look what's science, look what's technology, look what's art. And what Lynn said recently, I have it. The characteristic of mankind's natural development is the fact that the human species has some kind of voluntary capability which no animal has, to create the future by conscious intention. And then this is based on beauty, and it says it's based on a beautiful thing that you can create for the others, the discoveries of beauty, of art. And then there, if you start from there, man derives conceptions which create the basis for a nation state to be truthful and real and not just words. So it's funny because there are more and more attacks against the present situation of people saying our world is ugly and we should make beautiful. And for that, we have to attack, to go against a wave, to go against public opinion. And we need characters that should be men of character, as de Gaulle would say, or sublime characters, as Schiller would say in a more advanced conception. So more and more people are speaking about these issues. And if you, I was in Brittany, and I was really shaking people, and people reacted much better than ever I saw, I must say.
Well, also in France, you have a scientific tradition, which includes a certain degree of military and defense-related areas, but also nuclear power. To what extent has the green disease come into France from Germany?
Oh, it's very different. In Germany, it's aggressive, it's vulgar, it's violent. In France, it's pernicious, it's constant, and it fakes rationality. For example, the Greenies were the ones that supported us on Glass-Steagall the most. But at the same time, they call for solar energy, for all these things. So when we tell them it's contradictory, what they say is that, no, it's not contradictory. It's logic if you go a step aside. They said, you cannot go a step aside. So then they said, yes, maybe it's irrational, but irrationality is part of human beings. So we tell them, no, but this is a bad part and you should fight against it. And that's the issue. And you are complacent to the worst. And then you are fucked. And then you are going directly to your own destruction. So then they say, and some tend to react. The people with good faith tend to react on that when you corner them with that.
But to what extent is the nuclear program, which is very key for electrical production in France, to what extent is it under attack?
Well, under the table, what they say is that the Germans were idiot enough to drop it. We keep it, and this will make us the kings of Europe. No, some people say that, actually. So this is stupid, because if you have only the nuclear and all the ecologists bullshit around and nothing of industry, losing industry. Industry in France represents at this point 9% of the gross national product, 9%. In Germany, it's still 18-20.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you have nuclear energy as an asset if the industry is dismantled? It's crazy.
Yeah.
So they try to sell nuclear energy to China, to Russia, to Great Britain. The French have sold 2 nuclear reactors to Great Britain. So, but it's export nuclear energy. You imagine what it means? It's really insane. As such.
Jacques, speaking of insanity, we've seen a great outburst of insanity from the British monarchy. Prince Charles lashing out at Putin, saying that he's like Hitler, when in fact the Prince Charles family tree is very much a pro-Nazi family. But we've also seen the emergence in the city of London of this grouping which is trying to posture that they're going to be for a more human capitalism. And I know you follow these things quite closely. What's your sense of what's going on within the British monarchy? They obviously have a sense that their days are numbered.
No, what I said to people who said, oh, but this is terrible, Charles compares Putin to Hitler, Marine Le Pen wins, I said, there are two good news. Look, it's two good, excellent news, in the way Lin would say it. It proves, first, that Charles, by saying that, comparing Putin to Hitler, the Russians understand what the British Empire is, and also the French. They said, it's not some refined club some in Savile Row, is something different. So that's first. And the second thing is that what is shaking Europe. So the British, certain British, they say, well, we have to try to keep what we can, and maybe we have to retreat for some time, and then we would come back. So there is this thinking. There are other people that tend to be, in a certain way, a kind of mixture of patriotism and maintaining the British tradition. So all these people in the Financial Times took sides for Glass-Steagall. So you see these strange eruptions, which are not significant, I think, as things in themselves. They are significant as a response to what we do and a response to what is more and more understood among the people that think ahead.
Well, and let me finish, because we have just about 5 minutes left. As one of the most important concerns that Lyndon LaRouche has been raising is that we could be sleepwalking into a thermonuclear World War III. And I'd be interested in knowing, given what is happening in Ukraine and the push for NATO involvement in Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, joint maneuvers by NATO and the U.S. in Ukraine coming up, to what extent is there an awareness in France that we could very well be going into a nuclear World War III, that the policy of Obama, and if Obama is ousted, of the British Empire, is pushing us in that direction? Is there a recognition of that?
No. No, and somehow. What people say, the French are really raised into a mathematical conception of things and logic. So they say a nuclear war is not possible because it will destroy everybody. So when I tell them you don't take into account the irrational factor and the fact that an empire, when it's cornered, plays all its cards, and the last card is a war of all against all, and a thermonuclear war. So they said, you may be right, but we have our agreements under the table with the Russians to avoid the worst. We made some gestures, they made some gestures, but under the table we have our agreements. So then I tell them, but you know that NATO at this point has an option of a first nuclear strike, and what they want to destroy is the second strike of the Russians and the Chinese, and that's their option. So they agree. They said, yes, this is true, but it will never be done because of the American military. And the American military are our friends. We talk to them, we talk to the Russians, we talk to the Americans, and we have an arrangement that it won't happen. So they don't see, what they don't take into account is the insanity of people around the Queen of England, and the Queen of England herself, and Obama, and they don't see this chain of insanity as an immediate danger. And I repeat, and I keep repeating it, but they have, most people, there are very few who understand it. A French colonel who was very active in the Middle East has a very good understanding of it. But
That lack of understanding is, in fact, one of the biggest strategic dangers we face.
Sorry?
I said, that lack of understanding of the insanity of the British Empire is one of the biggest strategic weaknesses that might actually get us into a thermonuclear war.
Yes, it's exactly what they don't understand. Because, why they don't understand it, there are many reasons. What Lynn keeps repeating is what they don't understand. They don't understand between the difference between Great Britain, United Kingdom, and the British Empire. That are three different things. This they don't understand. They think that the British Empire is an extension of the British nation.
Or they don't think understand the British historically. Empire exists.
Sorry?
A lot of them think the British Empire no longer exists.
Yeah, sure. This they do understand, but they don't understand historically what it is. The Russians have a better understanding, because from a heartland country, they see the aspect of the Talosocracy, which means the empire of the seas. But the big problem, I had a discussion, I must say, with our friend Sergei Glazyev a year ago, and he said, our big thing, our big problem is that the British oligarchs, the French oligarchs, the American oligarchs, the Russian oligarchs, the Ukrainian oligarchs, and the Chinese oligarchs all have their combinations in the fiscal heavens, in all these islands and combinations of the British Empire.
Yeah.
And you have one, he said, you, even Americans, have one in Delaware, we understand it, and a few others in Nevada and other places. And we have the same thing in Moscow. You don't believe, he told me, the level of corruption in my country, and we have to fight this corruption. So I told him, look, Benjamin Franklin had to fight the same corruption when the wars of the War of Liberation started in the United States. And you have to think of yourself as fighting, as capable of fighting this corruption. And he said, yes, but it's
the same war today.
Sorry?
It's the same war today. Jacques, we've run out of time.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good note to end on. We're still at war with the British Empire, but it's vulnerable and can be defeated.
And we are in a better position for winning than a few months ago.
Well, Jacques, thanks very much for joining us today. And we'll be back next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for the next edition of The LaRouche Show.
Thank you very much.